In 2009, I moved from Boston, Massachusetts, to come back to New York, to actually the town I was born in, Hopewell Junction, New York. And I had amassed a lifetime worth of stuff at that point. I was about 40 years old, and I had a basement in my house that was filled with all manner of computers, documentation, floppies, you name it. And I had no place to put this. I looked into storage units, and all of them seemed expensive and weird and hard to get to. So I got this idea. What if I got a shipping container? And thus was born the Information Cube. This is Jason Scott. You're listening to Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It, a podcast about technology, stories, and debt. Huge thanks to Jeff Atwood, Daniel Boyd, and all the other hundreds of Patreon backers who are helping me to get out of debt and talk a little bit too much. So, life either puts you into contact with a lot of shipping containers, or you've never seen them. I'm going to assume the second for now. I mean, you've seen shipping containers maybe on television, or if you've been playing Grand Theft Auto or anything like that, but it's basically a large metal box with various sizes, and these boxes are perfectly set up for a whole range of moving equipment, either overseas or on trucks, you know, you name it. And shipping containers are a subject all their own. There are some wonderful books out there about the history of shipping containers. I actually attended a shipping container seminar. When they came out, they were a revolution. As I understand it, the cost of shipping a ton of material overseas was something like $3. After the shipping container, it dropped down to 14 cents. They're a modular storage unit, and there are millions of these things around the world. They have had so many different uses. They've been used as housing, as temporary structures, as offices on site. And I knew that if I looked around, I might be able to get one. My brother was, I would say, nonplussed, maybe neutral about the idea of a shipping container on his property. But he had the property space, so we both thought it would be okay for a while. And there was a company you could get them from for $100 a month. I mean, it's a no-brainer. The shipping container that I got was 40 feet by 8 feet by 8 feet. So basically the size of a large tractor trailer. And I really did have a lot of stuff from my old house. I mean, if you combine being known for collecting old computer material and old software and old magazines with the willingness to say yes to anyone who says they're getting rid of their collection and would you like it, I had amassed a very large basement worth of material. I spent about a year pulling van loads of material out of the basement and putting it into this large container, nestled under some trees along a fence. There's these doors on them that are really interestingly designed. You have to have both hands to pull them apart, and it's obvious that it was designed to always lock and never unlock by mistake, but also be able to open up in all sorts of temperatures from freezing cold to steaming hot. And once I opened up the box, I was looking down a room, you know, 40 feet long, that could hold, it felt, the entire world. Naturally, it absorbed everything I had in the basement back in Boston with no trouble. I stacked them up in the corners, put the computers into boxes and put those in there. I had piles of papers and piles of floppy disks and piles of clothes that I had even. And all of this material kind of got shoved into sides and then left there. I slowly moved away from Boston over the course of a year, and then, for the merest cost of $100 a month, I had an entire world unto itself in the backyard where I lived. So when something huge comes into your life, you become kind of a amateur archaeologist. You study the thing that you're renting or the large house that you're in, and you look around. You know, you can't help it. You look for evidence of what was going on before. You look for markings of how the item was treated or people who had been there. And in the case of my shipping container, what was obvious was it had spent some time in China. It had Chinese markings on the door, on some of the walls, on the lock, on the back, you know, just individual Chinese symbols to indicate something. It was also obvious that at some point it had been used to sell things. By that I meant that if you looked along the top of the ceiling, there were these pieces of paper that were hanging down that indicated different kinds of clothing and how much they cost. Just tiny notes that were coming through to somebody who would be walking up and down the shipping container looking at racks or whatever. You know, it was obvious that it had had several lives even before it became mine. One of the things about these containers is that, you know, they're nigh on indestructible. It can be reused and reused and repurposed. So my container had been around the world, and my container had been a store. And now it was the Information Cube. So a lot of people would hear me talk about the Information Cube as this sort of mythological collection. And of course, I would always wait for the people who would say to me, well, it's a rectangle, it's not a cube. The Information Cube had a couple roles over the years. It was an ark, it was a holding spot, it was a way station. I mean, people would have stuff that they knew was in some way valuable, you know, a suitcase full of Commodore 64 tapes, or a pile of magazines, or a pile of journals. And they didn't want it to go away and be destroyed. They wanted a narrative in which they handed it off. You know, as somebody who has worked with folks who have a hoarding tendency, in which I might say I have one too, what people really want at the end of the hoarding is a narrative where the items went on to a better life, another phase. They don't want a situation where things they were holding on to just ended up in the trash. They want to know it was all for something. I want to know this. So when I would say to people, oh, sure, I know you're getting rid of this, but why not send it to the Information Cube? It was a huge weight off their shoulders. They would load things into their car and meet me in a parking lot, or they'd do a prodigious amount of packing up in cardboard and send me 10 or 20 boxes, and I would end up holding them in the cube. Over time, I learned how to pack it all the way up to the ceiling. And in doing so, I became a world expert in something I really wish I had never become a world expert in, which was the range, variety, and the crush weight of Home Depot containers. Home Depot, which is located pretty much everywhere in the United States, is a warehouse that has all sorts of building materials and repair materials, and they would have lots of different plastic bins. And some of these bins would be $4, some of them would be $20, some of them would be $50. And over time, I discovered which ones cost how much and how well they would stand up if you packed them up 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6 high on top of one another. Now, I mean, I'll cut to the chase with that. It actually turns out the best boxes you could get from Home Depot were something called power packers. These were really thick, really tough, stackable boxes that were meant to be put on the back of trucks. You could stack them up in the back of your shop, load them onto a truck bed, and get down to the work site without worrying about how much jostling there was. So these things were perfect for loading up magazines or heavy computer equipment and then stacking them 5 or 6 high. Only problem was, once I stacked them, very hard to go inside. Meanwhile, I also discovered lots of boxes that would cost me $3, $4, or $9 that couldn't stand being stacked maybe 4 high for more than, you know, a week or two before the cracks would appear, the crushing would happen, and I'd open up the Information Cube just to see a whole pile of materials on the floor. It actually got to the point that I could see when they switched different manufacturing hubs for the exact same box. You would see minor changes in terms of the lines or how they stacked on top of one another. There were a couple cases where you'd have what looked like the exact same box, but there'd be a 3 to 5 centimeter difference on one side, and suddenly they didn't stack like they did before. Who wants to become an expert in this? But I did. After doing this for something like 3 or 4 years, I suddenly realized that I had created a monster back there. When you give yourself a lot of space, you will fill that space. You say yes a lot. That was always my problem. I've always said yes. If somebody asks me if I want to take in a bunch of stuff they're donating, I say yes. I figure it out later. I've discovered that people don't like it when the response coming back is for you to do some sort of high-intensity inventory of what materials you have. If you say to a person who has a whole bunch of material that matters to them, and then you say, "Well, I'd like it, but first could you generate a catalog?" they might not come back to you at all. But if you say, "Put it in boxes, I'll take it all," they get back to you very quickly, and they actually send along the material. The information cube would start to fill up, but then empty as I sent things away. But then it would really fill up, and then slowly empty. And then it would really, really fill up, and then it would never empty, until eventually I had a problem, which was the information cube was very hard to get into. The piles of boxes in every direction made it difficult to navigate, and material would be back there, and people would know I had it, but I had no way to reach it. So I reached out with a Kickstarter of all things. The Kickstarter was for what I called Information Cube 2.0, the idea being that I would buy professional quality shelving and be able to put the boxes into the shelving, ensuring that it was both reachable and able to stack all the way to the ceiling without things being crushed. And people, boy, did they come through. And suddenly I had a few $1,000s to go spend the money to get the really good shelves. Home Depot makes this shelf that is about $200 that can hold 1,600 pounds per shelf. And I bought something like 5 or 6 of these. I also bought a bunch of smaller shelves to be able to work on smaller items. I also bought a bunch of power packers, which ranged in price between $30 and $60, to ensure that everything was in as good a package as possible. And if I can diverge for a moment, the people who invested in that Kickstarter, they did it because they liked the idea. You know, there was very little they were going to get in return other than the knowledge that some shipping container somewhere in New York was going to look a little better. But they did it in such a way that the Kickstarter was fully funded in less than a day. I had a number of visitors to the Cube over the years. It became kind of a pilgrimage spot for a certain range of historian or techno fan. A couple documentary places came in. I was in a movie called Traceroute with the Information Cube. I definitely took a lot of pictures of it. It's a really impressive looking structure if you come into it cold. I mean, I open up this large green door, you walk in, and then there's just this wonderland of old machines. Everything from Commodore 64s sitting on top of floppy disk bins, sitting on top of old scientific journals or magazines. It's what people wish something could be. I can remember many a wonderful summer where somebody who was really into technological history would come visit me at the Cube, and we'd go through it and sort through things, and I'd lend them some items or give them some items. They'd really have a great time seeing so much history in one place. And I was proud of it, but I was also rather terrified of it. I mean, if you can imagine walking into a box full of old equipment and walking through it, and it takes a few seconds to walk through, and you realize that you, a single person, have acquired a truckload of history, and where is it going to go? How are you going to process it? And look, nobody likes to admit that it would take something like a medical emergency to make them institute any sort of positive lifestyle change. But basically, I had a heart attack, and the heart attack, if it didn't change too much of what I wanted to do, it certainly accelerated the schedule. I realized that what I had done to myself was I had given myself an insurmountable burden with no known escape plan and no way to ensure that if I was suddenly gone or had my priorities suddenly changed, that I'd be able to dig my way out of it. Over the years, as a way of showing how much certain friends meant to me, I would make them officially the receivers of the contents of the Cube in the event of my passing on. But looking back now, I think of the incredible, painful burden this would have been. People walking into this large box full of God knows what, aimed for who knows what, with no way for them internally to know if it was dog crap or diamonds. to look at a piece of paper and know whether or not this was an important piece of historical artifact or just something that fell into the bottom of a box someone had sent me. I had bills from when I was in my early 20s. I had love notes I had written in high school. I had hats that I thought were really cool in college. I had 14 Apple IIs. I had 9 Commodore 64s. I had piles of modems ranging from the early 80s to the late 90s. And how were my friends going to both mourn me and understand how any of it worked? So, I resolved. The information cube was going to have to go. Now, it turned out that when I had started collecting items in my basement back in Boston, I had done so because I feared there was a whole range of material that had no institutional interest. You know, that there were no museums or archives that would step up and take these items. And so I would take them. I'd be that museum. I'd be that archive. I may not have had the funding, and I may not have had the skills or the expertise or the abilities or the wherewithal to interface with all of the industry standards, but at least I would save it from the dumpster. This was a good bet, a smart move, a wise bet. But what had happened between, around 2005 and onward, were that institutions caught on. They figured out that it was meaningful. It was a part of society. It was a part of the advancement. It was a part of what made us what we are today. And so they saw value in acquiring these items. They might not do things like pull the information off the magnetic media, or be able to understand why these kinds of manuals were to be kept or so on. But they'd sort of get it. They would be willing to bring it into their environmentally stable, well-regulated, well-cataloged systems. Over the years, I have become acquainted with a variety of institutions that I'm really, really impressed by and who I trust. Places like the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York, the Babbage Institute in Minnesota, the Vintage Computing Federation, an incredible nonprofit that puts on the Vintage Computer Festivals and which has a warehouse full of amazing equipment, the Computer History Museum, and of course, the Physical Archive of the Internet Archive. These folks get it. If I have items that I believe are important, I can find a home for them. So I did. The Strong Museum of Play wants games. They were willing to take my video games, my computer game magazines, and even some computers. The Vintage Computing Federation, well, they were more than happy to take all of the home computers that I had, and they were happy to take lots of journals and magazines, which I thought represent some of the most important chronicles of the era of the home computer. And of course, the Internet Archive has taken all of my software. I rented vans, or they brought by vans, or I sent things through FedEx, and out they went, by the dozens. And during the weeks and the months that this took, I had people stop by or stay with me. My great friend Kyle Way, he flew down for a week, lived in this terrible, terrible room with me, and helped me move the boxes. My longest friend, Chris Orcutt, and his wife, Alexis, they helped me get through the final humps of it, the vans of the Vintage Computer Federation. It happened. It all came together. Undoing 25 years of collecting and giving myself the final chapter was such a weight lifted off of my mind and my living. Here in 2017, by my estimate, I've given away something like 90% of my possessions. The reason that was so easy was because they really weren't my possessions. I was just their caretaker. I wanted them to live on. The simplest desire was that my box, my information cube, would be an arc of computer history and of information, and that that information would live on. The people who had donated things to me in trust, who had stopped by to help me understand what some of it meant, who had visited it in their minds, we'd all had an amazing adventure in what I think was the best clubhouse I'd ever built. This is Jason Scott. You've been listening to the Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It podcast. Thanks to James Bakoyanu, Sam Johnston, Stefan Arantz, Astrid Smith, Kevin Waters, and the hundreds of other folks who helped make this podcast a reality and helped me pay down so much debt. I'm going to go a little bit off about the costs of the shipping container, just so you understand them. When I signed up with the company, whose name I refuse to say, the price was $100 a month, which sounded, fantastic. And when I signed up, they explained to me a simple fact, which was you were also paying a fee for insurance, and that fee would be $10 a month. So it went from $100 to $110. No big deal. And then, over the course of 7 years, this company, who are one of the largest providers of shipping containers in the world, explained to me that the price had to go up. It had to go up from $100 a month to $140 a month. Why? Because of the rising cost of fuel. That's right. Because of the rising cost of fuel, this large metal box in my backyard had to have its price increased by 40%. I raised a ruckus, and what I really should have done at that exact moment was said, screw you guys, and taken my ball, and gone home. I looked into buying the shipping container, and what they explained to me was that my shipping container was part of the rental fleet, and that they would really need to have me empty it, pull it out, and pull in another one from what were called the ownership fleet. Now, I don't know exactly what makes something a rental versus an ownership. And then, over time, these fuel costs started to increase until, by the end of the shipping container's life, I was paying something north of $272 a month for this shipping container that I had been paying $100 for. Now, 40 feet by 8 feet by 8 feet for $272 is still kind of a bargain compared to how much storage units cost, but I was just so angry and trapped, and yet the idea of having to empty this thing out to make them take it back, it just was too much for me. And this is how it can happen. And I'm sure it's happened to you. You discover that you're in too deep. You discover that you really should cut down costs, but the pain of going through the cost removal and having to find all new vendors and having to, it just weighs on you, and somehow you just struggle to convince yourself that just paying the expensive, ever-increasing fees is worth it. And I'll say that if I had kept the shipping container for something like 2 or 3 years, it would have totally made sense. But because I kept it for 7, that was thousands of dollars I'll never get back. That was a very, very hard lesson. And I'll say again that if it happens to you, you're not alone. And that there are people who will support you and help you dig out of that hole. Never forget that. See you next week.